Welcome back, everyone. Ready for another deep dive?
Always.
Good, because today we're going beyond those typical Viking tales. Raids, conquests, you know the drill. We're heading to Frisia in the Viking Age.
Ooh, Frisia. Interesting choice.
Not just as a victim, though. We're going to see Frisia as a player in this world of shifting powers and connections.
I like it. Complexities.
Exactly. And we're going deep with this one. We've got excerpts from a whole PhD dissertation that uses both historical texts and archaeology.
Multifaceted.
That's the goal. Buckle up, everyone, because I think we're going to uncover a much more nuanced picture of Frisia's place in the Viking world than you might expect.
I think you're right. You know, what really gets me excited about this dissertation is it challenges us to think differently.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Lay it on me.
So instead of just focusing on, like, territories and borders, you know, lines on a map, it brings in this idea of spheres of influence.
Okay, spheres of influence. So not just lines on a map, but something a little more fluid.
Exactly. More like overlapping circles of cultural and political power, you know? And if we think about Frisia before the Viking Age, it was kind of this borderland caught between the Frankish Christian world down south and then, you know, the non-Christian Germanic north.
So already a bit of a mixing pot.
Right. So those spheres are already intersecting there.
Got it. Got it. So then what happens when the Viking Age, like, really kicks off?
Well, the Frankish sphere, it expands. It formally absorbs Frisia.
Makes sense.
So on paper, now Frisia's firmly in the Frankish world, right?
Right.
That pushes, like, what we might think of as the border with the Viking world further north.
Okay, so Frisia's officially part of the Frankish kingdom. End of story.
Not so fast. That's where it gets good. This dissertation argues that even though it's officially part of Francia Frisia, it doesn't just lose its connection to that Viking sphere.
Interesting.
In fact, it becomes this fascinating zone of overlap where you find evidence from both spheres.
So it's almost like a cultural Venn diagram. I'm with you. I'm with you. So what kind of evidence are we actually talking about here?
Well, we've got historical sources, specifically old Frisian law texts. And what's amazing about these texts is that even though they were written down later, they're preserving legal responses to situations that are very clearly from the Viking Age.
Love a good primary source.
Yeah.
So we're not just talking about, you know, dusty old laws, but actual insights into how Frisians dealt with the realities of Viking presence.
Oh, absolutely. For instance, there are laws about infants being taken away.
Oh, wow.
Either in raids or, like, through the slave trade to, quote, heathen lands.
Right.
And while they don't always explicitly say Vikings, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty clear who they're talking about.
Exactly.
Wow. So imagine being a parent in Frisia at that time, living with that constant fear. That's heavy. Mm. These law texts, did they just acknowledge that this stuff was happening? Or did they actually try to address it in some way?
No, they did more than just acknowledge. There are regulations that gave specific rights to those who managed to return from captivity.
Oh, interesting.
Think about that. You're a child, you're stolen from your home, and then years later, you find your way back.
Right.
The community, they didn't just forget about you.
Well, well.
The law, it offered a way for you to reclaim your rightful place.
So that speaks volumes about the lasting impact of these encounters. You know, it wasn't something they could just brush aside.
No, not at all.
But it wasn't all doom and gloom, was it? You mentioned these spheres of influence. So this wasn't just about, like, Vikings coming in, raiding, pillaging the end.
Right, exactly. The texts also mention people being taken, quote, north over the sea or, quote, south over the mountains, which suggests movement in multiple directions, not just Viking raids.
Some more complex web of interactions.
Mm.
Fascinating. Okay, so to understand how Frisians themselves viewed their place in all of this, I guess we have to look at the stories they told about their past, right?
Right. Well, that's where this fascinating tale comes in. The dissertation looks at the story of Charlemagne and the Frisian king, Redbad.
Ooh, Charlemagne, big name.
Yeah.
I'm listening.
It's a classic power struggle. Hmm. They're clashing over control of Frisia.
Okay.
In the end, Charlemagne wins, but he grants the Frisians freedom and their own legal system.
Classic Charlemagne turning conqueror into, like, benevolent ruler.
Yeah.
I bet there's more to this story than meets the eye, though.
There always is. What's really interesting is how Redbad is portrayed. Mm-hmm. In these later versions of the story, he's transformed into a, quote, Danish king.
Hold on. Why change his identity? What's that about?
Well, remember, these texts are being written down, like, long after the Viking Age.
Right, right.
By making Redbad a Danish king, it kind of creates distance between the Frisians and their non-Christian past.
Interesting.
It aligns them more firmly with the Christian South, especially under Charlemagne.
So it's not just a historical account. It's like carefully crafted to shape Frisian identity in a way that suits the political and religious landscape, right?
Exactly.
Clever. Stories are great, but I gotta be honest, I'm always more interested in the stuff you can actually touch.
The tangible evidence.
Yeah, the tangible evidence. What can the archaeology actually tell us about Frisia's connection to the Viking world?
That's where it gets even more exciting, because we're not just talking about remnants of Viking raids, but objects that show a much more nuanced relationship, like, for instance, disc brooches found in Frisia.
Okay.
Stylistically, they're very similar to the ones found in, like, Viking settlements in Scandinavia and the Danelaw.
So fashionable Frisians rocking the latest Viking trends.
There you go. But see, these aren't just isolated finds. They paint this picture of Frisia as a vibrant hub of cultural exchange and trade.
Right in the middle of this Viking network.
Exactly. And then there's this fragment of a penannular brooch found in Frisia, likely copied from an insular, like, Irish or British design.
Hold on. Irish or British? That means Viking networks were stretching pretty far, right?
Right. It highlights how interconnected that world was. We also have a ringed pin, maybe from the Viking Age, similar to ones found in Norway.
Okay, so we're seeing connections to Scandinavia, to the British Isles. Frisia's really in the thick of it. But it can't just be jewelry, right? What about, like, everyday life?
Well, that's the thing. The presence of dirhams, so Islamic coins and hack silver, you know, chopped up jewelry typical of the Viking Age, that shows that Frisia was woven into these wider trade networks.
This is blowing my mind. Not just raids, but trade, fashion, cultural exchange.
It really makes you rethink that simple idea of Vikings just showing up, wreaking havoc, and that's it. There's so much more going on. And, you know, to get into that complexity, maybe let's circle back to those old Frisian law texts for a minute. Remember, we were talking about infants being taken away.
Right. And I mean, that's got to be just heartbreaking for a family, community, the whole society. These law texts didn't just try to sweep that under the rug, did they?
No, not at all. There's actually one statute that gets very specific about the rights of those children, you know, should they ever return.
Oh, wow.
It lays out the conditions for them reclaiming their inheritance.
So even after years of being, you know, separated from their families, raised in a completely different culture, they could still come back and, like, legally reclaim their place in Frisian society.
Precisely. And what's even more interesting is that the statute makes a distinction between infants being taken, quote, south over the mountains, which, you know, we think is probably the Frankish heartland,
right,
and north over the sea, which likely means Scandinavia. It suggests that Frisians recognize these different destinations and maybe even the distinct challenges faced by those who were taken.
Wow. It really paints a picture of a society that was actively grappling with this complex world that extended so far beyond their own borders.
Absolutely. And this brings us back to the story of Redbat and Charlemagne. Remember how those later versions kind of recast Redbat as a Danish king?
Right, right.
Well, there's another legal statute that kind of sheds light on this need to separate themselves from, you know, the Viking sphere.
Okay, go on.
It specifically mentions the Northmen, you know, a common term for Vikings coming to Frisia and taking people captive. But here's the thing. It makes a point of saying that these individuals were taken without their will.
So it's not just acknowledging that it happened. It's really emphasizing the injustice of it, drawing a clear line between, like, voluntary travel and forced abduction.
Exactly. It's a way of shaping the narrative, you know, highlighting the agency of the Frisians, or in this case, the lack thereof. And this emphasis on forced actions, it pops up again in another interesting legal provision. This one deals with a situation where a Frisian captive is forced by his captors to commit crimes in his own homeland.
Oh, wow. That's a whole other level of moral complexity there. Imagine being put in that position.
It's really hard to comprehend, right? But the law shows that they understood the coercion involved. It offered protection for those who were caught in this impossible situation.
So they weren't held accountable for actions that, you know, they were forced to take.
Exactly.
That's really fascinating. And it kind of challenges that simple notion of Frisians being just victims. They were dealing with really complex ethical dilemmas, you know, in a way that really acknowledges the nuances of these encounters.
Right. And remember, all of this is being written down at a time when Frisia is firmly part of the Christian world.
Right.
And that's crucial for understanding why these laws and stories were written the way they were.
It's about solidifying their place within that world, distancing themselves from their non-Christian past.
Precisely. There's even a passage that explicitly contrasts their past as heathens under Redbad and their present as Christians under Charlemagne.
It's a transformation story.
Right.
Rejecting the old, embracing the new.
Right. And it's not just about religion, but politics too. Aligning themselves with Charlemagne gave them legitimacy, you know?
Yeah, in this new world order. It's fascinating how these texts, they kind of let us peek behind the curtain and see how the Frisians were shaping their own narrative. But, you know, it can't all be super serious legal stuff, right? There has to be some good stories in there, too.
Oh, there are. There's this really interesting tale about the burdens imposed on Frisia, both from the north and later from the Franks. It involves taxes.
Okay, I'm always up for a good tax story. Tell me more.
So it involves this round shield and this tax collector with, like, incredibly good hearing.
Hold on. A tax collector with super hearing? This sounds less like a legal document, more like a myth.
Right. So according to the story, whenever the Frisians had to pay tribute, they would toss their coins into this shield.
Okay.
But the tax collector could only count the ones that he heard clinking.
Oh, I see where this is going. No cheating the system. I can see why they might have been a little anxious about paying taxes.
Right. It seems like they were constantly being watched.
So what do you think this story is really about? Like, what's the deeper meaning here?
It's probably a way of representing those pressures they were facing. The shield, often associated with warfare, you know, maybe it symbolizes the power of whoever is demanding the tribute, whether it's Vikings or Franks.
Makes sense.
And the tax collector with his super hearing, maybe he represents that ever-watchful eye of those in power, making sure no one's getting away with anything.
So more than just a quirky story, it's reflecting a deeper truth about the challenges they faced. I like it.
And you know, there's another detail that adds to this. It says that eventually Charlemagne relieves them of this burden.
Oh, okay. So it's not just about hardship. It's also about celebrating their eventual freedom and Charlemagne's role in that.
Exactly. But here's what's really interesting. This story pops up in Saxo Grammaticus's Gesta Danorum.
Which is?
It's a Danish text. 12th century.
Okay, so that's pretty late, well after the Viking Age.
Right, so this tale about Frisian taxes, it wasn't just some local thing. It was circulating more widely.
Maybe part of a shared memory or stories traveling across the North Sea.
Exactly. Even centuries later, we're still seeing these connections. It reinforces that idea of Frisia as a place where different cultures, you know, really converge.
Yeah, real crossroads. So we've got these texts, and they're offering amazing insights, but
they only tell one side of the story.
Right. To get the full picture, the multifaceted picture of Frisia in the Viking Age, I guess we have to go beyond the words and look at what they left behind. All right, let's get to that tangible evidence. I mean, the text's amazing, but now I'm ready for, like, the real deal. What do the actual archaeological finds from Frisia tell us about their connection to the Viking world that maybe the texts don't?
Yeah, the archaeology, it adds a whole new layer. It takes us beyond the official stories, the legal pronouncements, and we get to see, like, the daily life of people in Frisia.
Okay, so give me the highlights. What kind of everyday objects are we talking about here?
Well, jewelry's always fun. We touched on those disc brooches, but there's also this cool example of a modified Islamic coin, a dirham.
Wait, an Islamic coin?
Yeah, that was turned into a piece of jewelry.
So, like, Islamic coin turned Frisian bling. That's awesome.
Right. And it's not just like repurposing a valuable material. It's about mixing those foreign elements into Frisian styles, creating something new. Imagine you're a Frisian craftsperson. You've got this exotic coin.
Yeah.
You see its value, but you also see how beautiful it is.
Right.
So you turn it into a piece of art you can wear, a symbol of being connected to this wider world.
Man, that's a powerful image. It really shows how Frisia wasn't just like taking in these influences passively, they're making them their own.
Totally. And remember that ringed pin we talked about? The one that might have been inspired by like Norwegian designs?
Yeah, yeah.
That shows a flow of ideas and techniques, not just the objects moving around.
So Frisian craftspeople are getting inspired by Viking styles and like putting those aesthetics into their own work.
Exactly.
Man, it makes you wonder what those workshops must have been like, you know? Blending traditions, techniques. Mm. Pretty cool.
And it's not all fancy stuff either. Even everyday objects show these connections. We've got weights and scales from Frisia that are very similar to those used in Viking settlement.
Wow. So even like buying and selling,
yeah.
It was touched by this Viking influence. It really shows how intertwined they were.
Right. It's like a shared economic system, a standardization of trade across the North Sea. And that brings us back to that idea of the invisible boundary of the Viking world, where these artifacts are found, you know, from the fancy stuff to the everyday things. It tells us that this Viking sphere was much bigger than just their homelands.
Frisia, while politically part of Fringia, it was operating within this Viking network.
For sure.
Okay, so we've got texts, laws, archaeological finds. They all paint this really complex picture of Frisia in the Viking Age. But after diving into all of this, I have to ask, like, how should we think about Frisia in this period? Was it a Viking settlement, a trading post, or something else completely?
That's the big question. And honestly, the dissertation doesn't give us one easy answer, which I think is what makes it so cool.
Yeah, it keeps us thinking.
It forces us to think of Frisia as this fluid place where different cultures are, you know, constantly bumping into each other.
So less about borders, more about networks, connections, a constant movement of people, ideas, stuff. This has been an awesome journey, and I feel like I'm seeing Frisia, the whole Viking Age, in a whole new way. But I'm also left wondering, you know, the dissertation focuses on objects and texts, but what about the actual people?
That's the next frontier, right? What stories are still waiting to be found? What will future archaeology tell us about, like, the daily lives of those people living in this unique space where the Viking and Frankish worlds collided?
And that's what I love about history. There's always more to learn, always more mysteries to solve. So to everyone listening, I hope this deep dive has, I don't know, maybe inspired you to kind of rethink those traditional stories about the Vikings.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Frisia, not just as a place that was raided, but a place that helped shape that whole world. And hey, who knows? Maybe you'll be the one to make the next big discovery about this incredible time in history.
Keep exploring. Keep asking those questions. Keep diving deep.